Oi, 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 all persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals and Veterans Claims, draw an eye and give your attention, for this court is now in session. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Panel in the case of Chisholm versus Nicholson, docket number 050769, is reassembled. We want to thank counsel and party for responding to our notification that we had some additional questions that we... We also recognize you may not be prepared to fully discuss in great detail the issues or things that we might bring up now, but there are questions that came about during discussion, and we thought that the panel might benefit from your responses and that you might benefit from a better understanding of what those questions are if we were to ask for a supplemental briefing. So that's where we went. So for purposes now, why don't we just start with 10 minutes on each side, and we'll generate the questions as it starts, and see how this proceeds, since we haven't done this before. Would you like to start, Ms. Cook? And we'll give you a chance in rebuttal of 2 minutes at least.
All right, thank you.
If there's anything you want to raise at that time.
Okay.
Okay.
I actually don't have the questions.
You don't, that's right.
No.
No, I wasn't going to ask you to start.
Okay, I just want to make sure.
I just want to make sure.
But I wasn't supposed to just start.
Honestly, is everyone okay with that process and procedure? We had some additional questions that are going to be related to 38 U.S.C. 5314, as well as some questions regarding to whether the veteran is a necessary or indispensable party in this case, whether or not involves simultaneously contested claims. So if you'll give me 1 minute. I'm going to be referring to 5314 at the outset. And 5314A indicates that subject to various sections, the Secretary shall deduct the amount of indebtedness of any person who has been determined to be indebted to the United States by virtue of that person's participation in the benefits program. And the deduction is to come from future payments made to such person under law administered by the Secretary. And we didn't know if you had any additional comments with regard to whether that supported your position and argument that it was payments to be made to the veteran. And then we'll ask the Secretary if that supports your position or not with regard to that.
Well, I think it very clearly supports our position, Judge, because the offsets are to be made for the indebtedness of any person who is determined to be indebted. Mr. Chisholm has not been determined to be indebted to the VA. Only the veteran has been determined to be indebted.
That's correct, and this is an offset against the veteran, against payments to be made to him. So VA presumably made a determination that these payments were due to the veteran, and from those veterans they're taking an offset. And did you have an argument on that?
The VA does not have the ability, ever since at least Snyder 2 and possibly earlier, the VA does not have the ability to decide that the full amount of the past due benefits belong to the veteran, because statutorily 20% of it belongs to the attorney.
Okay. In this instance, though, the Secretary made a determination that the full 100% would be offset against the debt due VA by the veteran.
Correct.
So if the debt were $30,000 and the amount that were to be awarded under this were $20,000, just for discussion purposes, the veteran's debt would be $10,000. Now
his
your client
remaining debt,
his
right.
remaining debt, but your client has now come in and said no, that debt should go back up to somewhere like $15,000 because $5,000 should be given to him. And
correct.
Does that not then raise the question as to whether or not the veteran is a necessary or indispensable party here, or whether we have these simultaneous claims on that $5,000? Because the net effect, it seems, and you can comment on this, would be that $15,000 would then have to be paid down before the veteran would ever get any benefits, versus $10,000 being paid down before he got any future benefits down the road, from which he may then pay Mr. Chisholm. So this could be a timing issue in that regard. And again, go back to the indispensable party aspect or the simultaneous claim on that $5,000.
Well, in terms of the simultaneous claim, Under the rules, each party has 60 days to file a notice of disagreement, and in fact, even if it weren't treated as a simultaneous claim, each party has a year to file
a notice. Well, let me jumpstart that. Where in the record is the veteran a party to the stream of appeals that have come out on the case that is now before us where the veteran is not present?
He was notified along with Mr. Chisholm about, I believe, I don't have the record in front of me, but what the board said at page 6 of the record on appeal is that there is no evidence in the record to suggest that the appellant, that the veteran has not asserted that the fee sought by the attorney is unreasonable. So the board's...
But isn't the reasonableness of a fee a separate issue than the argument that we're being presented, which is the veteran's indebtedness, which has been reduced to $10,000, if that's the same example I was using,
right,
is now to be increased to $15,000. Yes, he had a debt to his attorney also, but isn't there a ramification or result that would come from this that would require him to be a party in any appeal to those decisions?
Not in this situation, Judge, because, first of all, he did not object at the time of anything. He didn't object to...
Well, maybe we ought to go to the record. You can correct the understanding we have is that there was an appeal from the decision by the secretary of the decision that it would be totally offset. I mean, there's documents in the record, if we're not mistaken, that say the full amount will be offset, and then the amount that you owe the government is down to $5,600 or something. That was one appeal that, as I understand, was actually appealed to the court and then voluntarily dismissed.
Correct.
And then there's a separate track that is going on, and we don't see the veteran in that track.
And you don't see what? I'm sorry, Judge.
We don't see the veteran being involved or notified of that separate track that is going on.
Well, let me present it from a different angle, which is that if the court rules in favor of Mr. Chisholm and orders the VA to pay him the $5,600 fee, the VA, first of all, can decide on its own whether that creates an overpayment. They're not required to determine that there's an overpayment. That's a separate proceeding. They can decide that it is or is not an overpayment to the veteran based on various rules and regulations of the VA in terms of whether the veteran was at fault, etc. And if they then determine that that additional money that they gave, that $5,600 that they gave to the veteran, was an overpayment, at that point they would notify him, allow him an opportunity to appeal. He could, file his notice of disagreement. He could file a request for a waiver, which may or may not be granted, again, based on fault of the veteran and other circumstances.
Well, I think we understand.
Before you go, is the time working? I did want to kind of be guided by this. We may extend some time.
No, it's actually not.
So let's just start at about 7 minutes. I'm going to say you had 3 already.
Fair enough. Thanks, sir.
Go ahead, please.
Sorry. Even given all of that process that you've just discussed, at that point, the veteran would be bound and the VA would be bound by whatever decision that we issue here with regard to the division of the award. So no matter how much notice the veteran got, and no matter what pleas the veteran made about an overpayment, the bottom line is that the veteran would be swimming upstream, because if we in fact, if our decision here was to rule that the attorney was entitled to 20% of the fee at the time the award was made, then all the veteran can talk about is what to do with the, quote, overpayment that was created. The veteran can't do anything about having a voice in our decision here. And I think that, at least for me, is the issue of, I'm not sure I quite understand it, because, unfortunately we didn't explore it until recently, is this in fact meet the requirements for a simultaneously contested claim? And if it does, what obligations are placed upon the VA to provide notice to those people who are potentially affected by the VA decision, and was that done, if in fact any notice requirements were are available in the statute? 7105A, I think, is a statute that talks about simultaneously contested claims, and then there are some regulatory provisions that implement that.
Well, I don't know the answer off the top of my head. I do think that it is answered in the record and would want to simply submit those citations supplement, but I do know that I do have a copy of Snyder 2, and the veteran is not was not added as a necessary party.
We understand that.
So, and that's the same kind, to me, it's the same issue, that the question is there a debt being created, and as you know, in Snyder 2, the court said it's between the VA and the vet.
We understand that it wasn't, that's not an issue that was discussed in Snyder 2. We understand that. And I think we would agree that we have potentially the same situation here. If we were to find, as you have argued, that an award has been paid, whether it be the award, you know, hypothetically passed through the hands of the veteran for only an instant, or whether it was actually resided in his hand, makes no difference. The cases are the same if we were to find that way.
As I said, Judge, all I can say is I do think if it's not in the record, I think it's in the claims file so that the record could be supplemented, but I don't know the answer.
Ms. Cook, who would you say represents the veterans' interests here, if anyone?
I think the VA does.
Okay.
They have a mutual interest in what happens to this money, at least in the short term.
But are they really, I mean, they're mutual, but are they coextensive?
Well, they're not coextensive if the VA takes a long-range view of the overriding policy, but that hasn't been their position, in my view.
But even not. I mean, I think I tried to lay it out in the beginning, but one of the situations that we're looking at, it seems, is VA, in their interpretations, determined that statutorily Congress has said that you're supposed to offset against the debt that VA has. The ramifications of that are, with continuing benefits down the road, that you will get those continuing benefits earlier if your debt is reduced by a greater amount. So if it's reduced from 30 to 10, you will get it sooner than if it was reduced from 30 to 15. That's a view that's included within the Secretary's interpretation. If we were to interpret the opposite way, then the debt would go up and the veteran would be without benefits for a longer period of time. And if that were the result of the case, would not the veteran have a separate and distinct interest that should be represented?
Well, I at the risk of repeating myself, Judge,
that's fine.
That's up to the VA if they choose to charge him a debt. We don't know that he will be charged with that overpayment. We don't know that a waiver of that overpayment would be denied. And the other interest of the veteran and the VA, as I said this morning, is that the veteran wouldn't have gotten any of these services. He wouldn't have any of the debt repaid but for Mr. Chisholm's efforts. And so...
Right, and whether you're right or wrong, the question I think we're asking is, should the veteran be represented?
Right, I understand that. And in terms of what opportunities he had, what notice he had, and what opportunities he had, I think that that's answered in the record, but I don't know the answer off the top of my head.
Okay. Anybody else? All right. We'll give you 2 minutes to rebut.
All right, thank you.
When we get done, if there's anything raised that you want to comment on. Similar questions. I'd like to start with 5314 as we did before and focus in on the fact that these are actually coming from future payments made to such person and whether or not that connotes a payment made to the person and this concept that it really is made to the person and then taken back to VA.
Again, Your Honor, we would reiterate the Secretary's position that even if you determine that this is a payment made to the veteran under past due benefits and for the purposes of future payments, being that the past due benefits award is the future payment or one of the first future payment to the veteran, that the secretary's position is that we created then, that created a problem between, do we deduct at that point first the offset, or do we deduct at that point first the payment to the attorney? The same kind of conflict that was created in Snyder with regard to an incarcerated veteran's deduction. And that in Snyder, the secretary was charged by requiring us to create a reasonable regulation which would resolve that gap between what comes first. And that the, in Snyder, the court said that we did reasonably create a regulation that resolved that gap, and in our regulation that what we said was that other statutorily mandated deductions comes first, so that regardless of what future payment or what the past due benefits award is, we deduct other statutorily mandated deductions or statutorily mandated deductions, and then whatever's left is paid to the veteran, and the attorney fees are deducted from that cash payment.
But isn't Snyder and the example used in the regulation, aren't they different? They're not really deductions. Snyder was a situation where instead of being getting 100%, you literally only got 10%. The other 90 didn't go anywhere. And in the example given, a retired officer or member of the service who was receiving retired pay would not get anything unless they submitted the waiver of dual benefits.
Well, the
isn't that different than this situation where a payment?
Yeah, the secretary would say no, that in fact, under 5313, that it was a deduction. It's, they calculate the award and they deduct rather the 90%. They reduce it by that amount, and the same with the termination of retirement pay. Again, it is a deduction. In fact, the language in Snyder would support that interpretation, because what the court did say in Snyder in addressing 5313 itself was that the secretary was able to say that it would take out the statutorily mandated deduction in 5313 before paying the attorney, and that though the attorney in Snyder argued the exact same thing, that he was entitled to 20% of what was calculated, not 20% of what was paid, that the court here said no, that there was a deduction, and they used the term statutorily mandated deduction or statutory deduction, and they considered it a deduction.
Well, to the extent deduction is used, it would be a deduction to the total amount authorized.
Right.
Versus here, the total amount authorized is the full amount. It's just part of it goes over here or part of it goes over there.
We're still in the language of 5314. The statute says the secretary shall deduct the amount of the indebtedness, and the secretary would assert that it is a deduction pursuant to 5314 in the same way that it was calculated as a deduction in 5313.
Any other questions on that one there?
I do. Ms. Drummond, Ms. Cook commented on the separate proceeding that would be involved in the overpayment, and could you enlighten me at least regarding, if you know, how that process would work?
Well, for one thing, the secretary would say that the overpayment here actually has already been finalized, that the veteran's overpayment was calculated back before Mr. Chisholm entered this case, and that he already sought waiver of that overpayment, and that waiver was denied through a final board decision issued in 1994 and with reconsideration denied in January 1995, approximately 10 months before Mr. Chisholm entered his appearance or his fee agreement in this case. So I'm not at all certain that the representation here is correct, that he would have an opportunity to challenge the overpayment again, as the overpayment has already been finalized. It's not
what about 5314B3 then? Is that just meaningless? If you hold these hearings before an offset is ever to take place, what does 3 mean? B3. Is that notification that is meaningless? Just notify them?
No.
And maybe it is. I'm just asking.
We did deduct. The appellant was notified about the deduction in this case at the time. Again, that he was notified of the waiver of overpayment.
Is that all he gets, though, is just a notification? You can do all of the B1 previously, 10 years earlier, and then when you finally get some amount to offset, all you have to do is give him a notification, period, and there's no right for anything?
Well, Your Honor, in the notification that's provided, it actually tells him that he is being notified that any future payments at all are going to be subject to offset pursuant to 5314. So, yes, the Secretary would assert that the appellant is on notice at that time that he, whether he gets payments from the Secretary in 5 years, 10 years, or 20 years, that he has.
So if you were to do it 20 years down the road, you wouldn't even have to notify him, you just could do it?
So the veteran wouldn't have an opportunity to contest, no matter how, let's just say the Secretary arbitrarily decided they wanted to deduct a payment. Well, never mind, I'm sorry.
Yeah, just following your argument. 10 years ago, you went through B1, total notification, total request for waiver, total indebtedness, you owe this money. 10 years down the road, he comes in, another claim, gets it processed, you do an award, and then you say it's offset. And that's the only thing that's required.
The Secretary asserts that that is what happened here, and yes, that under 5314, that he's received his notice. We would.
Right, so once you get the notice, it doesn't generate any other right to contest it or do anything.
Well,
the Secretary
VA
can just act.
Of course, he could appeal. VA would deduct his overpayment as it did here, and obviously in this case, the appellant did appeal the question of whether he should have had his entire past due benefits payment.
Okay, so when you get the notice, you're suggesting that he did get the notice and that he did appeal it and he did have that process.
Correct.
And did get
and
a board decision.
And it did go up to the board, and the board issued a decision saying that we correctly took your overpayment back.
In this case, I'm sorry.
No, that's. I think you're about to pick up where I was going, so go ahead.
In this case, even assuming that occurred, in this case, after Mr. Chisholm filed his request for attorney's fees, and let's assume that in this case, the VA found in favor of the veteran, right?
VA would say that the VA found in favor of statutory mandated deduction. That
well, they found
the
against
government.
Okay,
so
they found against they found against Mr. Chisholm, correct?
To the extent that Mr. Chisholm did not get attorney's fees, yes.
Right, and the result of that was that the veteran got an increased amount of reduction of the veteran's prior overpayment.
Correct.
So the veteran benefited from that, correct?
Arguably, yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
The veteran benefited.
Now, Mr. Chisholm files an appeal. Mm-hmm. The outcome of that appeal, if we were to rule in favor of Mr. Chisholm, would be detrimental to the veteran.
Well, Your Honor, the penalty.
Is that,
yeah.
If
you were to rule in favor of Mr. Chisholm, then the interest between Mr. Chisholm and the veteran would potentially be in conflict.
That's correct.
But if we ruled
in favor of Mr. Chisholm, wouldn't the veteran be? Wouldn't the effect of that would be to increase the amount of debt that was owed to the government?
Correct, Your Honor.
Correct. In that situation, is there some sort of obligation on the part of the VA to notify the veteran during the process of their adjudication of this claim to give the veteran the opportunity to file a notice of a disagreement or a substantive appeal to that decision after a statement of the case is issued?
Well, if this is going to the question of simultaneously contested claims, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
I have to admit I haven't read the regulations and statute on that immediately before this, but it would appear to the Secretary that I'm not certain that there's actually two different claims here. Those actually talk about situations where there's a claim involved, and I'm not sure that the veteran has a claim. To a certain extent, the veteran has agreed, to the extent that the veteran signed on to the fee agreement, you know, the processing of the fee agreement, he's consented to the terms of the fee agreement. So if the Secretary were to find the fee agreement valid, it's really a matter of interpretation of the fee and the fee agreement and the regulations.
Why wouldn't he have an interest? I see our time is up, but we're going to continue on just for a few minutes. Why wouldn't he have an interest in that interpretation? Why wouldn't that be a separate interest than Mr. Chisholm has? And why wouldn't that be two parties? And if simultaneous claims doesn't fit it, why wouldn't due process and fair, you know, necessary party concepts.
The secretary would have to look into, you know, the position that would happen. But the secretary would say, with regard to the appeal at the court level, that you do have a rule under 3B, which requires service to all interested parties upon the part of the appellant when they file their notice of appeal. It's not clear for the secretary from the record whether Mr. Chisholm served Mr. Limoges in notice of the fact that he was appealing the determination, but that would, in fact, serve at least as some notice to the veteran in this case, had he been served or has he been served, that there was, in fact, a potential for him to be affected by the outcome of this, and if that was done in a way that might relieve the court's concerns.
Ms. Strumman, Judge Hagel posed a hypothetical that indicated the veteran might be at a disadvantage, or at least from an accounting standpoint, depending upon how the court rules, could in fact have the VA decrease the offset amount. Under that circumstance, who is representing the veteran's interest?
If the VA, it would depend on if the veteran has representation.
My question is, do you believe the secretary is representing the veteran's interest now in the event the VA has to alter its
decision?
The secretary
would not assert here that they are representing the veteran in this case. The secretary is representing the department, or I'm representing the secretary, which stands for the department, but no, the secretary could not stand here and tell you that we're representing the veteran's interest. We think in this particular instance that the secretary's interest and the veteran's interest seem to be running parallel, but I could not stand before you and tell you that I represent the veteran in this matter.
I didn't think you would, Ms. Drummond, and I appreciate your candor. So the next question is, in the event that those interests are not aligned, who is representing the veteran?
Can't answer that question.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you very much. Ms. Cook, would you like to stand at the podium? Are there any questions from judges to follow up here, or would you like to make a comment?
I just have a couple of quick comments, Judge. There were two board decisions. They're both in the record, and they cross-reference each decision, so there, at the very least, there's some notice there.
Up to that point.
In terms of...
I guess if you go through the record, and if we go off a supplemental briefing, you can think about all this, but it appears as though the record has, right up to that point, dual notifications, dual parties, dual understandings, and then one gets appealed on one track with the veteran represented by Mr. Chisholm, and one gets appealed on another track without the veteran, and the question becomes, should not the veteran have been
right
in that case?
Right.
And then if we, depending, we'll send this out, but one of the things we're wondering is, should that be... Does that warrant remand for notification at the board, or is it the type of thing that can be done, as you suggest, perhaps in our rules, with notification to a veteran, if at all, that should be done? And we want to thank you for coming back. Again, we thought it would be helpful from not only what you could give us, but perhaps you understanding where we're coming from with the possibility of a supplemental briefing order coming out from the court. Is there anything else? All right, court will be adjourned.
All rise. Court is adjourned.